At this point, I think we should consider the award of the medal, the Armstrong Medal, and I believe that Howard himself is going to take on the chore of starting that ball rolling. Am I right, Howard?
Yes, Mr. Toastmaster.
Come up here and get by the mics.
I'll try to span this gulf between the view that you've had into the future tonight and the view that Captain Round is going to give you into the past. I am bound to say that after listening to Captain Buechner's exposition, and it's the best exposition that you'll ever get, for who better than an ex-ham or a present-day ham can so well understand the thinking of your minds as to pass down to you the views of the top side of the Brookhaven Laboratory. I'm bound to say, though, that I feel tonight pretty much the way the builders of the old Spark rock crushers must have felt when some of us youngsters began using the word electron in the radio art. I rather feel like going fishing. A lot of those fellas did too, but it didn't make any difference. And it wouldn't make any difference what us old timers do now. It's the youngsters that want to take their cue from what was said here tonight and tie it in with some of the things that I know our medalists will tell you of the ancient days and try and forecast where the youngsters are going to be 25, 30 years from now. Well, now, you've already read the citation, and you know some of the boundaries within which Captain Round has worked. But if you left it to him to tell you the most important things, you would go home without hearing the story. So I'm going to tell you them. These days, it's a poor amateur who can't sit down and wake a few continents every day of the week. But when Captain Round, H.J. Round, Youngster Round, started in as one of the operating staff of BA, I believe 60 miles daylight was considered to be a good working range. Occasionally at night they did a bit better. And during the period of 1907 to 1912, when there was one and only one transoceanic circuit running, it was a constant fight to keep out of bankruptcy. Those were the days when I was just coming into the yard. And you couldn't get any reliable information about what was going on in the yard. It wasn't in the books. Everybody considered what he knew was a trade secret. And later on, people were uncharitable enough to suggest that the reason for the secrecy was that somebody else might find out how much they really didn't know. Now, those were the days when I was trying to find out something about radio and the Glace Bay Clifton Circuit. And during this period, I noticed in the London Electrician, there occasionally appeared articles that was signed by a chap by the name of Round. And I observed then a thing of which I have since become more cognizant. an Englishman knows how to use the English language. When Round got through with one of his articles, you knew exactly what he meant. You understood it. And H.J., you cleared up a great bit of my early thinking, and I'm proud to admit it. Now, I look forward in a vague way to the hope someday of meeting him and asking him all the questions that had been left unanswered, but I never looked forward to meeting him under the circumstances in which I did. And that I'll tell you about later. But I want to scan quickly over his career. You'll find him accompanying Marconi across the Atlantic between both ends of the Clifton-Glace Bay circuit. You'll find him flying kites astern of the Princess Mafalda in the South Atlantic with Marconi, receiving signals from Clifton up to 6,000 miles. You'll find him 1,000 miles up the Amazon in the heart of the jungle, engaged in making high-power Marconi stations work over 700 miles of jungle when nobody else could make them work. And Paul Godley can tell you later on more about that. You'll find him in the forefront of the oscillating vacuum tube development at the beginning of World War I. And after the war, you'll find him replacing the spark at Clifton and Carnarvon with vacuum tube transmitters, 10,000 volts on the plate, long before we had anything like that in this country. There was a time, and I go back to the time when I was learning my radio, when England and the Germans raced for first place, with England slightly in the lead, and the war no third or fourth places. Perhaps we may have been down fifth or sixth in those days. And remember that after World War I, they were still leading us. You'll find him transmitting signals on 100 meters in 1921 from England and receiving them in Norway over a distance of 700 miles, again leading the world. And this, I'm sure you'll all find of special interest. He was the one man in England, Paul Godley will tell you, who gave him encouragement that in 1921, Paul might be able to receive 200 meter signals across the Atlantic. But now I want to tell you about the great thing that H.J. did. On my way to France, in October 1917, I had the opportunity of stopping off in London. And of course, I went to Marconi House and asked for Round. Fortunately, he was in, and he came down in the uniform of an intelligence officer, and he took me in to his diggings up on the top floor, where he had all sorts of listening in circuits. And that evening, we really listened in on the war. I really listened in on the war, for that was my first knowledge of what it was, what the use of radio in warfare really was. And I learned also from him that evening of the great importance of the problem of amplifying short radio waves before detection. I learned that the capacity of the average tube swamped your ability to amplify the signals that had to be amplified, signals 150 and 200 meters. With the nature of the problem, later on I learned of its solution. Now, I was able to retrieve two of these little tubes that voyaged around here this evening. And this, the little fella, small diameter plate, known as a V-24. And it was used in the intercept and intelligence stations to build up to and successfully operate 19 stages of radio frequency amplification. The way in which it was done, and mind you, the screen grid or neutralization was then unknown. The way it was done was by the most extraordinary amount of ingenuity in the design of the coils loading the plate circuit, and in the acceptance of the fact, which no one else seemed to have appreciated at the time, that it didn't make any difference if you only got 1 3/4 or twofold amplification per stage. If you put enough of them in there, eventually you could get down to tube noise. And 500,000 times magnification has been attained with the round 55 amplifier. Now, what was the point of getting this great amplification? Well, it was this. One of the great problems in World War I was the direction finder. To spot subs, to spot zeps, and most of all, to keep watch on what was going on in the German fleet where it lay at harbor in Wilhelmshaven. Now you can imagine some of the results which the application of such a device had to the intelligence service when the other fellow, feeling absolutely secure and hundreds of miles away, was sending his stuff out in clear German and never suspecting the existence of any such device. But you will not hear anything about this from your medalists this evening. And you won't find out anything about it by consulting the publications of the medalist. I've heard the story that the Battle of Waterloo failed to make the front page of the London Times. I'm inclined to believe it's a true story. If you look through the classic paper entitled Direction and Position Finding by Captain H.J. Round, 30 pages of the most comprehensive treatment of the subject, you will find tucked away somewhere this one small statement with reference to an equally great event. Quote, when one examines the scale of a direction finder and sees how small a thing 1 degree is, it seems almost impossible that the accuracy we obtained was possible with the number of quite big errors that we had to correct and the many small ones we could not disentangle. The extent to which direction finding was trusted by the authorities was really remarkable. And I can instance one case where a most important event in the history of the British Navy was brought about by an observed motion of less than 1 1/2 degrees in the daytime. Not until the opening of the discussion of that paper do you discover what this 1 1/2 degree deviation was all about. Reading from the remarks of Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Henry Jackson, you will find the following quotation, and it refers to the prelude to the meeting of the British and German fleets at the Battle of Jutland on May 31st, 1916. Quote, I was first Sea Lord at the time, and so was responsible for the disposition of the Grand Fleet. But if the German fleet got to sea first, the chance of a meeting in waters not unfavorable to us was remote. Our object was to try to get to sea before or shortly after the Germans, and hitherto we had not succeeded in doing so. Later on in the afternoon, it was reported to me that the German ship conducting the wireless had changed her position a few miles to the northward. This is across 300 miles of sea. Evidently, she and her consorts had left the basins at Wilhelmshaven and had taken up a position in the Jade River, ready to put to sea. This movement decided me to send our Grand Fleet to sea and move toward the German Bight at once and try to meet the German fleet and bring it to action. This they did with their usual promptitude, and the result was the famous Battle of Jutland. And it was directly brought about by the careful and accurate work of Captain Round and his staff, for which I hope they will now accept my belated thanks and appreciation. I and some others here this evening have some first-hand knowledge of the magnitude of the problems faced and successfully solved by Captain Round. We all join belatedly in the privilege of honoring him tonight, and I know that all of you will join with us in expressing the hope that in the event of any future disturbance of the peace of the wild, which God forbid we have, that we have, again, with us on our side, helping us, the future Captain Rounds, who will do as good a job for us as he did 30 years ago.